Pardon up, theater people. Welcome to your program, Is Your Ticket. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. The program, Is Your Ticket, is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. As many of you know, your program, Is Your Ticket, is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater and smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on this show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. My guest on tonight's show is writer-actor Barry Levy, who wrote and performs his upcoming one-man show, Hoaxacost, which will play 23 performances from September 5th through the 30th, 2018, at the theater at the 14th Street Y. I love that theater. It's a great theater. Okay, here's a sensational teaser from the press materials for the show that had me very intrigued. Here we go. What roles should past horrors play in defining ourselves, our religious views, or even our politics? Is there such a thing as a contemporary Jewish identity independent of the Holocaust? Should there be? What if the Holocaust had never happened? Mahmoud Abbas has said it. Poland has said it. Some people currently running for our Congress and in our president's coalition have said it, that's for sure. The Holocaust didn't happen. What did? Such an interesting thesis, and I'm really, really excited to hear more. So let's bring him on. Hi, Barry Levy of Hoaxacost, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Hi, Sean. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here, especially following a recent podcast with Chagrin Valley Little Theater, where I grew up and did a bunch of shows.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you about that. That's such a great theater.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I had a great time, and I was there for it was a fundraiser to improve the already beautiful theater. I think it was to redo their lobby, and lots of great Broadway talent was there. And I noticed that we had friends connected on Facebook.
Oh, that's funny.
I love that. I love that you brought that up.
I gave a good Artful Dodger there, and a not so good little McAfee kid in Bye Bye Birdie. Not my finest moment. Puberty struck somewhere in the middle there, but it was a great place to grow up
and super nice people.
Yeah, super nice.
I saw that you're friends with Greta Rothman.
Sure am.
And I interviewed her, and she was delightful.
She's the best.
Out of all of the interviews that I did there, she was one of my favorites.
She's one of the first sort of cabaret acts I saw in New York after I moved here. She put together her own cabaret, and it was one of my first nights out in New York going to see a friend do a cabaret, and she was amazing.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
that's kind of like not to sound like Drew Barrymore, but who doesn't love something like Drew Barrymore? It's kind of magical that happens.
Yeah.
Wow. New York creates great magical moments like that, and I think that's wonderful. Let's have you tell us a little bit more about yourself.
More?
You can talk about Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
Well, I actually grew up in a nearby town called Beechwood, which you'll hear all about in the show. It's a special little place. It is known for its mall and for being 80% Jewish. And Chagrin Valley was not far away, and went to Chagrin Falls to do theater, went to Shaker Heights High School to study playwriting during high school, and it was a great place to grow up. Northeastern Ohio is fantastic. What else can I tell you about myself? Grew up in Ohio, came out east for school, and moved to New York in 1999. Have been here ever since, except for 3 years. I went out to the West Coast and studied playwriting at UC San Diego. Other than that, I've been a New Yorker longer. Lived in New York longer than I lived in Ohio at this point. So if anyone out there wants to do some math, you'll figure out I'm 40.
you look 29.
Thank you so much.
I'm just
going
to roll with it. Aren't I a great host?
Fantastic.
I love that. I see here that you are a 2-time O'Neill finalist. That's very, very cool. You have a Bachelor of Arts from Yale and an MFA from UC San Diego. So that's a great pedigree.
Thank you. I loved all those places. UC San Diego is fantastic. I mean, who doesn't love 70 degrees and sunny every day, but also just the theater program is amazing. They give you a full production of an original play that you write each year for 3 years in a row, working with the best actors and designers and stage managers and directors. Just fantastic.
Wow, that's great. And you're right, San Diego is beautiful.
Amazing.
Yeah, I lived in Southern California myself. My sister lived in San Diego, so I was there all the time, and it's just, it's lovely, just in general.
Yeah.
And you get to go to school there.
Yeah.
And you said that they give you, for 3 years, you wrote your own individual, independent plays, and And they produce them.
Yeah, the school in association with La Jolla Playhouse does a full production every year.
Oh wow!
Of each of the playwrights' plays. Yeah, sets, light, stage, the whole thing. I was on the studio theater at the Mandel Weiss, the Forum theater there. It was huge, huge space for my third year show. A little too big for my third year show, but it was an amazing experience. Really fantastic.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And the great thing about it is that you're learning by doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can learn a lot of theory, and it's great to learn theory. You constantly, I think, learn that, but you really never know until you get in and you experience the stress of doing it and rewrites and things like that and stuff on the fly. So
yeah.
That's terrific. How and when did you come upon the idea of Hoaxacost? How did that arise?
It was back in 2004. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was president of Iran at the time?
Right.
Not prime minister, president. Anyway, he was first sort of making a big splash in American media for all of his Holocaust denial. And I just remember, I mean, at the time, it was just like, what? People deny the Holocaust? Who on earth? What this craziness? And it seemed funny to me. And just instantly, I just had this idea, like just like laughing to myself, reading his nonsense, like, oh. You know how I'm going to make a killing in theater? I'm going to make a comedy where everything that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says is true. I'm just going to chase that to its conclusion and just say he's right, and like, what would that mean? It'll be hysterical. I'll make a gold mine. I don't think I understood at the time how people make gold mines, because not so much of a gold mine idea.
Right.
But it sure has been a fun journey, sort of following that thread ever since. I was lucky enough at the time to be in a writing group at the Ars Nova Theater, where I got to sort of start playing with the idea. In my first inception, it was going to be sort of an Indiana Jones kind of Da Vinci Code kind of parody, like around the world, crazy adventure, looking up all of this, relics, or I don't even know what the first idea was. It was bad. And and then around the same time, my friend Jeremy Gold Cronenberg, who directs the show, was also doing a fellowship at the Prospect Theater Company.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of their Dark Knight series at 59 East 59, he was handed sort of the theater through Prospect Theater Company for a weekend to do whatever he wanted. So he asked me if I wanted to do something. And I said, yeah, I want to do this Holocaust denial around the world Indiana Jones adventure with a cast of thousands. And he said, great, make it a one-man show, and you've got a deal. So Hoaxacost was born. I just sort of chucked the Indiana Jones thing and started the one-man show thing.
Wow. Now tell me, since you have chucked the Indiana Jones...
Gone. Concept, chucked.
Chucked. Gone. Okay.
Goner than it was in Crystal Skull. I mean, it's gone. Yeah.
For the record, I, as a writer, like most of my original ideas, I'm glad nobody ever sees them. They evolve into something that really makes sense. Well, you have to put it in front of an audience and read it out loud and all that. But tell us about what it's... So it's evolved to now this you challenging... I always forget his name. I remember on The View, Whoopi Goldberg called him, I'm a dinner jacket.
Yeah, that's very close.
Yes, and everybody laughed at
yeah.
that.
Very close. We can call him that.
Okay.
I'm a dinner jacket.
Right. So you're challenging I'm a dinner jacket theories and his crazy, wacky thoughts and beliefs on this. And you take that in a fictitious direction to see what that would actually be like. And that's the state of the show now, right?
Yeah, I think one of the big changes... that is still the shape of the show. The way the show has changed from that production to this is over the years. So originally an actor actually played the role of Barry Levy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that first Prospect Theater Company 59 East 59 production, we had an actor doing it. In subsequent productions, we had another actor doing it. And it's actually in the last couple of years, I started doing it myself. So that's one thing that's changed. But the general structure stayed the same, where it's about an unreliable narrator named Barry Levy, who sort of goes around the world interviewing Holocaust deniers and getting in deeper and deeper and deeper, sort of going from a local level. He starts with a professor in Chicago, and then sort of gets sent on this around the world journey from Chicago to London to Paris, and then it gets international, and then it gets real weird. He just gets deeper and deeper into the craziness of the Holocaust deniers. And that has stayed the same.
That is so cool. That's a great concept. I love that.
Thanks.
And what was it like? Were you your own dramaturge or dramaturg, however you want to pronounce it? Were you your own dramaturg, or did you have somebody come in on a peripheral basis or an objective basis and challenge things in the script? Or
I've had 1,000 informal dramaturgs. I mean, never a formal dramaturg for it, but everyone... This is my first time doing a one-man show, and I'm not... I feel like I've had more... Paradoxical as this might sound, I've been more solicitous of input and feedback and dramaturgy from everyone involved in the project with a one-man show than I have been even with some of my more traditional plays. It's been a real learning process for me to even learn how to structure a one-man show, how to make that dramatic, how to take it from a sort of very didactic, I researched all this stuff, and here's what Holocaust deniers think plays to a real dynamic story with an arc. And I mean, I like challenging myself when I write to do a different form each time and a different style each time. This one was really out of the box for me. And so, from the writers group I was in at the beginning at Ars Nova, I would bring in pages and people would give me feedback to Jeremy as the, you know, Jeremy's really helped develop it with me from the beginning. I remember going home for either Hanukkah or Passover, I forget. One of the Jewish holidays, I was back home at my parents in Cleveland. Beechwood. And really struggling with the script and just calling Jeremy, just talking stuff through. There's a part in the script I really remember this was happening with. There's a part where Barry starts to... Talking about myself in the third person is weird, but talking about myself isn't, so... the narrator, Barry, starts getting seduced by some of the deniers' arguments about the numbers being fuzzy, the 6 million figure being a fuzzy figure, fuzzy math. Mm. So I started to put words in this denier's mouth. I started doing some research and started doing fuzzy math of my own with the numbers to see like how evil this guy could sound. And it just became... I just remember sitting there at my parents' dining room table just being like, it is so easy to manipulate these numbers to say whatever you want them to say. And I just started scaring myself. I started really freaking out about like, what, I'm becoming a bad person. I'm becoming a Holocaust denier. Why is it so easy to make it sound like this never happened? Mm-hmm. And I remember calling Jeremy, freaking out about that. So he's held my hand a lot through the whole process. But everyone along the way, even people at the 14th Street Y now, Antonio, my press consultant, has talked me off the ledge with a couple things about the end of the play recently that I'm still sort of tinkering with a month out of opening. Everyone has offered me a wealth of ideas that I'd be a fool not to sort of take in all their great feedback. So,
sure. Well, that seems it's big. It's a big idea. And I would think that there would be quite a few people who came and saw the show who would challenge certain things. I mean, the whole concept itself is a challenge, mm-hmm. overall. But I think that there could be historians who come see the show who are like, you maybe didn't get that right, or that's exaggerated or something like that. Has that happened?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I actually really try to get the historical parts right. I hope not to get challenged. Well... This is a tricky question, Sean.
Awesome.
you asked the good ones. Everything that I have the deniers say in the show comes from their writings, their speeches. They're actually things they said. I'm not putting words in anyone's mouth.
That's great.
At the same time, the show does go to a more and more farcical place as it goes on. So not everything that happens in the show actually happened in real life. So it's sort of a fine line to walk to say, like, I'm trying to be historically accurate, but at the same time, none of it really happened. So I don't know how I rectify those two things. You have to come see the show to find out. But people do get a little... the show ends in a very farcical place that I hope the intent is for it to end in such a place that what is and isn't real is pretty clear. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it ends in a scary place, not a very comfortable place. Mm-hmm. And I think those two things happening at once... does leave some people very unsettled. I have had people at the end of the very first performance at 59th Prospect Theater Company, someone did stand up and start yelling lies, lies, lies. And
really?
You know, yeah. And someone else, these were all not paid for people, not even people I knew. Someone else in the audience who was a stranger to me started talking to her and saying, you know, but don't you see, you know, the X, Y, and Z just happened. Like, this must be fake. This can't have really happened. That, I don't want to spoil the ending, but, you can't really believe that all of these things that they just had happened were real, right? You know, this was a satire. And the lady was upset, said, I know it wasn't real, but I think he, and she's pointing to the actor who's still bowing at the time, he's still on stage, I think he's so sick, he thinks it's real. And people have gotten a little turned around. Even a journalist, the last time I did the show, who was writing about the show, waited for me afterwards just to say, you know, I just want to check. Do you really think the Holocaust happened? I just want to make sure you know it really happened, right? And I was like, of course I know it happened. Why do you think I wrote this show? To spread awareness about Holocaust denial and how dangerous and scary it is. But most people, I will say, most people recognize it ends in a pretty farcical place, and the intent is to sort of expose and start a dialogue. But I think because it ends in a very uncomfortable place, where maybe people don't want their hero or their narrator to end, makes it really challenging.
And while hearing something like that is awkward, it must be very satisfying as a writer deep down, because you know that you've elicited the reaction that you want out of the audience.
Yeah, I think the fact, if it was just the one lady screaming lies, lies, and everyone else started screaming lies, lies, I maybe would have felt really uneasy, like, oh God, did I just, you know, break the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. But the fact that someone else, who's a complete stranger to me, just started a dialogue with her, and that they started a conversation about what they'd just seen, it actually felt fantastic, because that's what you want. That's absolutely what you want theater to do.
Sure.
So that felt really great.
That's great. It entertains, educates, and edifies the audience, I think, if you're doing it right. Tell me about the comedy in the show. Is it funny at times? Can it be fun? I mean,
it is intentionally funny, and that's before we even get to my acting, Sean. It is, yes, there's a lot of humor. I try to find a lot of humor. Obviously, a lot of it's pretty dark humor. Some of it writes itself. I mean, some of what the deniers say is so cuckoo that you can just put it out there and it's funny. But then again, some of it's terrifying. So I think there's some moments of humor that come right out of the denier's mouth. There's moments of humor that come from Barry, the narrator's naivete a little bit. He's in an interesting relationship with his boyfriend when the play starts, and an interesting relationship with his family. So there's some humor there in those dynamics and those relationships.
Tell me a little bit about your favorite character other than third person Barry. Who's your favorite character to play in the show?
100%. My favorite character in the show, my favorite one to play is myself, because that's easy.
Right.
But my favorite character in the show is not me. My favorite character in the show is actually my boyfriend, Anthony, who's a character that a sort of fight with Anthony is what springboards the whole journey. He is Dominican American, and he is a little sassy, and he is actually the voice of reason at the end of the play, which is also, I think, takes some audiences by surprise, that it's the non-Jewish character in the play who actually speaks the most truth about the Holocaust at the end of the play. So he's a really fascinating character. He's difficult for me to play, but he is really fun, and I like sort of subverting audience expectations with him. He's very funny, which is always fun to play.
Sure.
Yeah, he's definitely my favorite. He was also Dr. Ruth's favorite. Dr. Ruth came to one of our shows, and during one of our talkbacks.
No way.
And she just came in off the street. She just saw the poster on the street, and she had her husband come in, or I don't know if it was her husband. She had someone come in and ask at the box office, you know, Dr. Ruth is outside. She's really intrigued. She just wants to make sure this isn't actually a Holocaust denial thing, is it? And we were like, the box. I was like, no, it's comedy. It's against Holocaust denial because she's a Holocaust survivor.
Sure.
And so she came in. She took their word for it, and she came in with her husband just off the street on the strength of the poster. And then we had a talk back afterwards, and she was the first person to raise her hand, and
I was
freaking
gonna say, please
out.
Tell me she stayed.
She stayed, and she's the first person to raise her hand, and they're like, any questions? Who wants to discuss Holocaust? And I'm freaking out because someone told me in the meantime she's a Holocaust survivor, and she asked the first question, and her first question is, I just want to know, do Barry and his boyfriend get back together again when the play's over? Because if not, they should come see me. So she really took it for, you know, in a way she took it as the relationship sort of comedy drama that it, that the shape of the story is built around. So I loved her for that. That was fantastic.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
She's adorable. I remember, my husband David and I, flew from, I think he may have been back from Cleveland to New York. I don't know. But anyways, we were on a plane, and she got on the plane, and she's like tiny. She's the tiniest little woman, but she has such an aura and a presence about her. And of course, I remember listening to her way back in the day on my AM radio in my 72 Pinto. So that tells you a little bit about how I am there. But what a great story.
Yeah.
And it sounds like the character of Anthony is almost like the audience. He's what the audience represents.
Yeah, I think there's a big shift. I think the play starts and the audience is aligned with Barry, and by the end of the play, hopefully they're aligned with Anthony, and I think that's part of what makes the play interesting and unique and a worthwhile but also challenging journey for the audience. I think there's a little bit of a bait and switch there that's fun for me as a writer, but part of what makes it a unique journey.
Sure. Yeah. Switching up a little bit, go against the grain a little bit, and surprise the audience. That's always very cool. Now, I see here that you did the show in NYC Fringe in 2014 and won an overall excellence award for the show. That's awesome.
It felt great. Terrifying. That was, again, I was still working with an actor at that point when we got into the Fringe, a fantastic actor named Adam Green, who was also very important in the development of the piece. And he and his wife got pregnant right around when we were starting to gear up for the Fringe and had to bow, and he bowed out. And I remember thinking, well, do I cancel? I mean, I'm just going to back out of the Fringe. He's the only actor who does it. And for some unknown reason, I just decided to go ahead and do it and perform it myself. I hadn't acted since high school. But I figured if there's one role I can do, it better be myself. So I stayed in the Fringe and acted it myself, and it was really gratifying and rewarding for it to be received so well, because I was scared. Well, I'll say shitless. I was scared shitless, Sean. But it went great.
We have an expensive rating, as I've said before, so you can say shitless.
I figured I should take advantage of it at least once during the course of this podcast.
Thank you for checking that box. I love that. Fringe is, not only would that be scary, but my husband and I did a play called At the Flash that won some awards. And we did it at Fringe in 2015 or 16, the year before they took a year off. And it's a very hectic schedule. So you're performing the show for the first time, learning it, memorizing it. Even though you wrote it, you still had to memorize it, because he co-wrote our show and he still had to memorize it because he performs it. And on top of that, you get like 1 hour to go in and tech. You get 2 hours to tech your show, 1 hour to run through it or with all of your cues, and then another hour to time it with your stage manager. What was the pressure of that like?
Well, it's one of the reasons I do my show with a stool. That's my set. I don't know what you guys did, but I learned to think small in the Fringe and have quick turnarounds. What was yours like? What was your setup and breakdown and all that?
Well, it was just a stool, and he was playing five different characters in five different decades in the same gay bar. It was all fictitious. And he did have a stool, and we've been doing it for so long, I now have to write a new decade into it. But yeah, it's tough, and Fringe is tough, because I always tell everyone the goal in Fringe is to surface, because there's 200 shows. So if you can surface with your ticket sales and awards and your publicity and that, then you've done it. There's about 20 shows, 30 shows, I think, in Fringe at surface. Mm-hmm. Sounds like yours was one of them.
I had excellent PR from Campfire PR that helped a lot in that regard. I was lucky to be in a smaller theater space, so it was easier to sell out 30 seats than it was. We transferred afterwards to Baruch as part of the Best of the Fringe. I forget what they called it that year. It wasn't Best of the Fringe anymore. Fringe Encore series.
Yeah, Fringe Core.
Fringe Core.
Yeah.
That was a bigger challenge to go from selling out 30 seats to filling 200. I couldn't have asked for a better Fringe. It went great, from the publicity to the sellouts to the award. It was all very gratifying.
Yeah, it is. It's a great experience. It's an honor. And it sounds like it went really, really well. And yeah, Campfire's great.
Mm-hmm.
Campfire's awesome. They're great publicists. I love Antonio and Katie.
Antonio and Katie are the best.
Yes, they're the best. Now, I wanted to ask you, as the person who was the actor, the eventual actor, and the now actor in the show, what was the biggest challenge technically in being the actor in your own show that you wrote?
Technically in the acting, like the hardest thing about acting, or like the hardest thing about juggling? I'll tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is actually the hardest thing about acting again. It's actually something I never knew about acting before. When we were at Baruch, and we had a 200-seat theater, and the day that there were 17 people showed up. This was over the high holidays on September 11th, which of course is happening to me again at the 14th Street Y, but we'll have bigger crowds at the 14th Street Y. I forget if it was Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur or September 11th. It was one of those 3 dates and at Baruch, and 17 people came. And I just remember it was just so hard to find the energy to do the whole show,
right,
and to act like it was full, and to act like They were also very quiet, 17 people. It was a very somber day. Maybe it was number 11. I was just getting nothing back.
Yeah.
And it was so hard to find that strength as a performer, because I'm not trained as a performer. I haven't gone through this for years and years. I haven't had a bunch of performances like that and built up a toolkit of how do you do that. No one had prepared me for what to do when you just feel like you just want to crawl off the stage and go back into bed and just tell all those people to go, you know, F themselves. Yeah. And just to find that was really the hardest thing. I mean, I'm sure other people would say there's many other areas of my performing I should focus on in addition to that. But for me, like living it in the moment, that was just a really tough thing that I didn't appreciate that actors have to do when they're not getting the energy back from the audience. How do you manufacture it yourself?
Right.
That was the hardest acting technical challenge for me. Now, to be fair, I have not focused much on my dialect work. So that's my next challenge. But no, for me, that was the biggest.
Wow. Now, was there... did you have to overcome the connection that you had as the writer of the piece with being the performer? Because I remember when my husband was performing our play, he said he really had to sort of step back from it, especially when he started working with our director, David Zapp. It's because the director then sort of mints their own impression onto the show.
Uh-huh.
So he had to kind of forget everything. It kind of reminded me of when, this is my second waitress reference for today, but I love that show. When Sarah Bareilles stepped into the part that she wrote, pretty much, she said that one of her biggest issues was that she had to not get ahead of herself by knowing exactly what was going to occur.
Mm.
And by the way, she was phenomenal in that. Did you have any of those problems?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that Jeremy, as we rehearse, keeps impressing upon me is to, you know, make sure that I'm in the moment and not sort of projecting the ending and not knowing where we're going. So I think that is hard, not, you know, probably hard for anyone, but especially if you're the writer and you've, you know, you know backwards and forwards. But
sure.
Also, I think, yeah, and there's also times where, you know, I think something makes total sense because I wrote it and he has to kind of make me see that, like, textually it doesn't make the most sense. And, you know, last night we got into a discussion about even just the word "well" in one of the lines, and he kept saying, "I don't understand. You don't need that well. Why do you keep saying that well?" And I was like, "Oh, but the well is so important." And eventually, it was like, "Okay, well, you've got two choices: you can cut it, or you can act it, because the well's doing nothing right now." So then I tried really hard to act the well, and I think we might end up cutting it. He's probably right, but I do find that I am actually a much kinder playwright to my actor now that I am the actor. When I had an actor in it, I would rewrite like crazy, and it would be like a performance day, and I'd be like, "We're making changes." And he's an actor, he can roll with it, he can memorize the lines in 2 seconds. And now that I'm the one who has to rememorize the lines, there's no more changes. Script is frozen, it's done.
Probably about your second tech in, you're like, "No, I can't take any more."
Yeah,
that's at least what my David tells me. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with Jeremy Gold Cronenberg. I know he's your director, and it sounds like he lets you find things on your own, like the word "well."
Like the word "well."
So that's really cool. But I saw that he's very, very heavily resumed out of Ohio. Did you meet in Ohio?
We sure did. We met even before middle school, I think late grade school. Yeah, we've known each other for a very long time, which makes me very comfortable working with him as I, you know, dabble back in acting. And he's been instrumental in helping develop the show from the very beginning. So he is really very talented. He comes from musical theater. He studied musical theater at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, Sarah Lawrence. And we have a love of musicals that, you know, we were in several of them together. We have a legendary Merrily We Roll Along from high school.
Oh,
and
I really love that show, by the way.
Well, it made me love the movie. Was that Lady Bird that they do Merrily?
I think so.
Yeah.
Great.
Brought back a lot of memories. And Jeremy was also infamous for knitting on the school bus on the way to and from school and field trips. He would knit vests. He had a vest obsession in high school. Any picture of Jeremy from high school, he is wearing a vest that he made himself.
That's my husband will love that because he knits all the time. We have a tree as you walk in, and it just looks like a giant Christmas tree made out of yarn. It's very, very, it's scarves and hats and all of that. So you probably have a lot of that as well from Jeremy.
Yes, everyone has a vest from Jeremy somewhere in the back of their closet. Oh.
Well, he is himself very, very well resumed. It says here that he did the first New York revival of Caroline or Change.
He sure did. That was an amazing production.
And it was nominated for the New York Innovative Theater Award as Outstanding Production, a BFA in Acting from Ohio University School of Theater, and an MFA in Directing with a Musical Theater Focus from the University of Cincinnati, and a list as long as your arm of credits.
Yeah. I feel very lucky to work with him as just for his talent as a director, and then on top of that, it's gravy that I feel so comfortable with him from sort of a lifelong friendship. You reminded me when you were mentioning his BA from Ohio University that I visited him when he was in college there, and we got a bat in the house while I was visiting, and you have never seen two men run screaming around a house like you did when there was a bat in Jeremy's house in college.
Wow. I wish that, YouTube was around that.
Yes, thank God it wasn't.
Right. And cell phones, you can record, and such these guys screaming around.
Yeah.
Hey, I'd be right there with you. For absolute death.
We would have needed you to get the bat out of the house, Sean. That's what you would have needed to be there for.
Are you kidding me? I'd be like the cartoon where the woman climbs up on the chair in her high heels and she, with the baseball. No, that's no. Do you want to talk about any of the other people on your production team? Any other designers you'd like to mention?
Yeah, we have a fantastic lighting designer named Kia Rogers, who is a partner with Flux Ensemble.
Cool.
We're working with a production assistant who's actually a recent directing grad from Columbia MFA program named Kim Kerfoot. And of course, through the Y, we're working with one of the best technical directors around, Chrissy Wright, who's amazing. She's the resident technical director for
the
theater at the 14th Street Y. And then, and then there's all our collaborators at the, co-producing with us is the theater at the 14th Street Y. And everyone there, Renit and David, Rebecca, London, Lauren. I mean, everyone there is just amazing to work with. So it's really a giant team of collaborators to put together one little show with a guy in a stool.
That's the interesting thing about theaters that people don't realize that behind the guy in the stool is just an army of highly, highly talented people doing so much heavy lifting back there. And I remember I've worked with a stage manager who said, if you can't see me, I've done my job.
And
which kind of makes me feel bad because I feel like they should all be coming out and bowing as well. I think that's just me. I'm kind of a big old donkey girl scout that way. Well, before we go, can you please tell our listeners your social media information, including information about the show and social media information, as well as all the upcoming production information for Hoaxacost?
Sure. So Hoaxacost tags are real easy. It's Hoaxacost at Facebook and Hoaxacost at Twitter. That's HOAXOCAUST. I think it's in good company on Facebook right now with a lot of Holocaust denial pages. Just kidding. It's not a Holocaust denial page. No one's going to track you. Well, I can't promise what Zuckerberg's going to do, but I promise if you go to Hoaxacost on Facebook or Twitter, it is. It goes to a satire, and it goes to. We're actually posting a lot of really interesting articles tracking all of the white nationalists running for Congress right now. We're being a little activist and fighting the good fight. But please join us on Facebook or Twitter. And we're also sending out coupon ticket discount codes via Twitter and Facebook. So it's really good to follow us for more information.
That's very cool. Any information or social media about yourself that you'd like to talk about? Or are you a low-key presence on social media?
I think I should probably be a bigger presence on social media, but no, I'm a pretty low-key presence, but I'm on there. I'm Barry Levy, pretty easy, BarryLevy. I got in early. I'm there on Facebook and Twitter, just my name, you can find me.
Very, very cool. Yeah. What's next for you after this?
This is going to run for a little while. We're running, 20-something performances, and we may try to, if there's any interest from schools, line up some additional matinees, so we may get close to 30. So this is going to keep me busy for a little while. And after this, we will see. I'm about to actually, once a year, some friends and I go to a little writing retreat upstate and sort of clear our brains of everything old and start something new. So I'm actually doing that next week, so we'll see what new thing pops out of this Hoaxacost weary head.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you many figurative broken legs on this.
I don't have an understudy, Sean. Don't wish me that.
I know. I was feeling it's still hard to say when my people I'm interviewing are next week are going to be going up in a in a play, but it sounds challenging and funny.
Funny, yes, it's definitely funny.
And educational and dramatic at times. I think it sounds terrific. And everyone go see it. It's just amazing. Well, you've been a delight.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it. This has been a total fun for me.
Well, good. Good. Yeah. I'm glad you have. It's been incredible talking to you, and so thank you for being with us, writer, actor Barry Levy of Hoaxacost.
Thanks, Sean.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, folks, the proverbial 11 o'clock number has been sung, the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain. You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket at facebook.com, Your Program Is Your Ticket. I'm on Twitter, at Program Ticket. The website is yourprogramisyourticket.com. A quick thanks to North Coast NYC, the hip-hop improv theater ensemble that does my intro and outro music. You might be hearing it right now. You heard it in the beginning. If you're not hearing it now, you'll hear it in just a few seconds. Your Program Is Your Ticket is on iTunes and SoundCloud. Rate me, write me a review, and review. Subscribe. Please do all that. It helps with my profile, and I appreciate it. Folks, take a little time to see a show this week, and don't forget to give a smaller show some love. There's lots of theater gems out there. Until our next show, good night, theater people, and Kirk.
Your program is your ticket. What? Your program is your ticket. What? Your program is your ticket.
Clinton.
Your program is your ticket.
Clinton. Yeah.